Well, we're down to our last session together. Not so happy to see this week go by. I've really enjoyed being with you. And before we started this conference, as I prayed about it, in fact, I think I shared this with you the first time we were together, that I was praying. I prayed that God would use this week in my own heart, God would speak to me, and that He would speak to you. And I know He's spoken to me, and some of you have told me that He has spoken to you, and it's just really great. It's just something special when we can be together like this. Met one of you down in the foyer as I came in this evening, and we were talking about the conference a little bit and how it was good to be together. And the thought that was running through my mind was, if it can be like this here on earth, what will it be like that day when we stand face to face with the Lord Himself? I mean, that'll really be something, and we'll look in his face, and we'll be able to talk to him face to face, and all the questions that we have that we want to ask, we can ask them. He will give us the answers, and that's going to be eternity. So that's before us. A week like this kind of makes us homesick for that, doesn't it? Well. I have two titles for this talk that I'm going to give tonight. And one is short enough to get on the back of the tape box. The other one isn't. But I like the longer one better. The longer one is How to Blow 1,161 Years of Progress in a Decade. In other words, How to Finish Well. And I'm jealous for all of you. That you do finish well. All of us know of Christians who have not finished well, who have gone along and all of a sudden things have fallen apart for them, and they have hurt the people around them, they've hurt themselves, they've dishonored the Lord's name, and they have really messed up their lives in such a way that the pieces are just laying there. And who knows how to put them back together again. And that's not just the average Christian. There are Christian leaders that have gone through that kind of thing, evangelists, seminary professors, pastors, etc. And that's scary because I think, how do I know I'm not going to be on the casualty list next year? And how do you know you're not going to be on the casualty list next year? Because a lot of people wind up there every year. And so I want to tell you the story of the man who blew 1,161 years in a decade. And maybe from the lesson from that man's life, we can avoid a few things. The story starts back in the year 2092 BC. That was the year that Abraham left Haran. Now, we find this in Genesis chapter 12, where God came to Abraham and He said, "Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you." Now, God had great plans for Abraham. He said, "I have a global strategy here, and you are at the core of it." He said, "I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be blessed. You will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all the peoples on earth will be blessed through you." And so you can imagine Abraham going to his father and saying, "Father, I've decided to leave." "Well, where are you going?" "Well, I don't know." "Well, if you don't know where you're going, how are you going to know when you've gotten there?" "Well, we'll just have to wait and see. But you see, I'm going to found this enormous nation. I just need the space. And so if you excuse me, I'll be leaving." And so the father raises his eyebrows and thinks, you know, this... he's 75 years old. He should have known better. I mean, at that age, you should have some sense. But Abraham, at 75, took off for a place he didn't know where he was going on this promise. God says, "I'm going to make a great nation, and all the nations of the world will be blessed through you." So he got out there in the desert, waiting for this family to show up. And You know, first year came by, nothing. Second year came by, nothing. 5 years, nothing. 10 years, nothing. You know, every year the Christmas postcard. Well, son, how's it going? And well, Christmas didn't happen right back there yet. So, what kind of postcards did they send? Did they have any holidays back there? Anybody know? But anyway, they were the postcard. How's the nation going, son? Well, not doing so well. Finally, after 11 years, his wife said, hey, this isn't working. And so he took Hagar to be his wife, and they had Ishmael. And God said, that doesn't count. So they waited another 14 years, until 25 years after Abraham had left Haran, then Isaac was born. Now, so Isaac was born in the year 2067. And then Isaac was about 40 years old when he got married, and it was 60 years then between the time that Isaac was born until the two sons, Jacob and Esau, were born. And so at this point, how many years have gone by? Let's see, 60, about 85 years had gone by from the time Abraham had left Haran, and this enormous nation was up to three people. So then the nation grew. Jacob had 12 sons, and those 12 sons got married and had sons, and so they had a clan of about 70. Now, it was kind of a ragtag bunch. They really weren't all that nice. You know, they wanted to get rid of this one brother that they were jealous of, and they kind of tossed a coin as to whether they were going to sell him or kill him, and they decided to sell him. And they got kind of pushed out of shape over what happened with one of their sisters, and so they went in and slaughtered every man in town in this one particular place. And so this group of 70, I mean, they were what you'd call a bunch of bandits, maybe. And so it was that group of people in the year 1877 that arrived in Egypt because of a famine. Now, you'll notice something a little bit strange there. Look at those dates. See, back there they had the quaint habit of counting backwards. And so you have to kind of get onto that to understand the Old Testament. But they arrived in Egypt, and they spent 430 years in Egypt, and then came the Exodus. And so they left Egypt after 430 years. Now, just stop and think. They had 215 years from the time Abraham left Haran until they went into Egypt. And then they spent 430 years in Egypt. And so we're talking about 645 years that they had been in the making. And they went into Egypt as kind of a clan, and not a very nice bunch of people. In slavery for 430 years, that's no place to get a culture, is it? And so they came out. God called it a furnace. He said, I had you in the furnace there while you were in Egypt because I was preparing you. And so God was at work, and so God's purpose was to produce this people. And then they spent 40 years taking a trip that should have lasted about 18 months. The reason it took so long was because of their disobedience. But as they were in the desert, in those 40 years, is that thing moving? Okay. Well, I'm relieved to discover that everybody thought it was moving. Well, in Deuteronomy 28, verse 9 and 10, we find the same thing repeated. Deuteronomy 28, 9 and 10. It says, the Lord will establish you as a holy people, as he promised you on oath, if you keep the commands of the Lord your God and walk in his ways. Then all the peoples on earth will see that you are called by the name of the Lord. And so while they're in that desert, wandering around, really because of disobedience, God gave them a culture. And that culture is absolutely phenomenal. I mean, you go back and read it. I mean, it's dry. It's tedious. It's like, you know, studying, going to law school. But you read through it, and you see what's in there, and it's absolutely mind-blowing. It deals with economics, it deals with health, it deals with with society. It deals with religion. It deals with relationships. The sense of justice and everything that's there is absolutely phenomenal. And to me, it's one of the great evidences of the fact that there is a God and that he is involved in the affairs, the daily affairs of man, because those people had no possible way of coming up with that kind of a culture. And God, from one day to the next, gave them that culture. And God says, now, you keep these commands and walk in the ways of the Lord, then all the people of the earth will see that you're called by the name of the Lord. And so God had a global strategy in working with the children of Israel. So they entered Canaan, and after, we'll skip over a few details here, after a period of time, down in the year 1050, they had their first king, Saul. He reigned for 40 years. They had their second king, David. He reigned for 40 years, and then they had the third king, who was Solomon, and he reigned for 40 years, and in that time, he built a temple. Now, that temple represents sort of the zenith of the trajectory of the nation of Israel. And in 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 24, we find that it says this: the whole world sought audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom God had put in his heart. And so it worked. God took this people, and they were nobody. And he raised them up, and perhaps because they were so unlikely, and because they turned out to be what they were, the whole world was attracted by that. He took his time, so everybody in the world knew about those people living in Egypt. And when they left, the whole world knew about those people leaving. And when they became a nation, it says the whole world sought audience with that nation because of their wisdom. And so we find that God was working in his he's working his strategy out. Now, in the year 931, the kingdom was split. So the temple was built in the year 960, and 29 years later, the kingdom was split. And in the next chapter, let's see if I can find the reference. In chapter 14 of 1 Kings, we find that God passes a sentence on the nation of Israel, and it says, the Lord will strike Israel so that it will be like a reed swaying in the water. He'll uproot Israel from this good land that he gave to their forefathers and scatter them beyond the river, because it provoked the Lord to anger. And so here we find that in that short period of time, Israel, a kingdom was split, Israel was sentenced, and they went into two parts. In the year 736, Israel went into captivity by Assyria, and in the year 596, Judah went into captivity by Babylon. Great start. But then they just took a nosedive, and it was over. Now, the question is, what in the world happened? What in the world happened? Well, let me show you what happened. We start out in Deuteronomy chapter 17. Let's take a look at this. This is going to be our basic passage here. Deuteronomy chapter 17. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, God is giving some instructions. And he's giving them through Moses. And in verse 14, it says, when you enter the land, Deuteronomy 17, 14, when you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you and have taken possession of it and settled in it, and you say, let us set a king over us like all the nations around us, be sure to appoint over you the king the Lord your God chooses. And he says he must be from among the people. Then in verse 16, he starts out and he gives three things that this king must not do. Three things this king must not do. One, the king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them. For the Lord has told you, you are not to go back that way again. So the first thing was, he wasn't supposed to buy a lot of horses. And especially from Egypt. Now, what was the big deal? What about horses? And especially from Egypt. Then he says, the second thing he's not supposed to do, verse 17, he must not take many wives. or his heart would be led astray. And then the third thing, he must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. Those are the three things that he wasn't supposed to do. He wasn't supposed to take horses from Egypt, and of course the horse then was the line of defense. It was the defense system. from Egypt, they were the best horses around. And then he says he must not take many wives, or they'll turn his heart astray, and he must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold, and the reason for that is that so they will not consider himself better than his brothers and turn from the law, verse 20. Then there was one thing he was supposed to do. We find that in verse 18. When he takes the throne of his kingdom, he is to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law taken from that of the priests who are Levites. Now, what it really says here is that that king is supposed to write for himself the law. Now, what is the law? Well, it's the first five books that we have right here. It's about that much right there. Now, that's a lot of writing. Now, any good administrator would delegate that one. You know? And especially because they didn't have Bic pens and they didn't have legal pads those days. It was, you know, you have a pot of ink and you have this, whatever they used to write with, and you dip it in. And you make a letter, dip it in, and make a letter. You know, it was in Hebrew, and so, you know, it was more complicated. And so, especially if you didn't know the language. But how long do you think it would take a person? How long would it take you in the process of, you know, dip it in, make a letter, dip it in, to write these first five books? I mean, it would take a hunk out of your first year, wouldn't it? Now, why was he supposed to do it himself? Well, you'd sure know it was in there when you got done, wouldn't you? And that was probably the point. And also, after all that work, you wouldn't want anything to happen to that copy. You'd keep your eye on it. Man, I put a year into that baby. I don't want to lose it. And so it would be valuable, and you'd know it was there. But then it goes on to say, and it says, it is to be with him, and he is to read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees. And so he's not supposed to make a copy, but then he's supposed to read it every day of his life. Well, now, let's flip over to 1 Kings chapter 10 and see what happened, why this nation went down the way it did. In 1 Kings chapter 10, we read verse 24 already, where it says the whole world sought audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom God had put in his heart. And so Solomon was a brilliant man, scientist, and author. And in verse 26, it says, Solomon accumulated chariots and horses. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horses, which he kept in chariot cities and also with him in Jerusalem. The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones, and cedar as plentiful as sycamore fig trees in the foothills. Solomon's horses were imported from where? Egypt. Where wasn't he supposed to buy horses? Something's wrong. So, the royal merchants purchased them from Kee. They imported a chariot from Egypt for 600 shekels of silver and a horse for 150. They also exported them to all the kings of the Hittites and of the Armenians. Armenians. And then chapter 11, verse 1. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women beside Pharaoh's daughter, Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonites, Hittites. They were from nations around which the Lord had told the Israelites, you must not intermarry with them. And then dropping down to verse 3, the last half, it says, his wives led him astray. Verse 4, as Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God. He followed Ashereth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites, which we described this morning. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely, as David his father had done. And then it describes in the rest of the chapter how God raised up three adversaries and how the kingdom was split and then fell apart. Now that's phenomenal. And think, how stupid could that man be? But he wasn't stupid. I mean, he had a terrific start. In chapter 3 of 1 Kings, it describes him in his early days. And it says in chapter 3, verse 7, God comes and says, okay, now you're going to be king. And Solomon says to God in verse 7, now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of my father, but I'm only a little child. I don't know how to carry out my duties. Your servant is here among the people you have chosen, a great people. So he says, give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who is able to govern this great people of yours? And then God says in verse 12, I will do what you have asked. I will give you a wise and discerning heart so that there will never have been anyone like you, nor will there ever be again. Terrific start. Brilliant man. How could he go so wrong? Well, we can be sure of one thing. There came a day where he stopped reading this book. That's what happened. Maybe he got busy. You know, maybe there's a strike among the dock hands, or maybe there's a shipment of trouble in the customs. You know, there's a shipment of apes and peacocks coming in, and he's busy. And the publisher after him. Publishers were after him for the final draft of the manuscript on wise sayings, and he was behind. And so, you know, the pressure's building up, and so he just thought, man, I just don't have time. Besides, I know what's in there. Or maybe he just got bored after reading it for 30 years. You know, he thinks, oh, man, I know this thing by heart. And here I am reading it over and over again. Maybe he just pushed it aside because he was bored. Or maybe it was a combination of both. He just let other things creep in. Because one thing is for sure. There came a point where he stopped fearing the Lord. And so we go back to Deuteronomy 17, and we find that the solution here, the important thing, is not what you know. This is the thing that is so frightening. Your good start that you have right now is no guarantee that you're going to finish well. Solomon had a better start than either you or I, and he didn't finish well. You're a smart bunch of people. And a lot of you have been tremendously successful. But your brains will not guarantee that you will finish well. Your knowledge of the Bible. I mean, Solomon probably could have quoted the Bible, those first five books, backwards. Your knowledge of the Bible will not guarantee that you will finish well. It's not knowledge that we're after. Knowledge is important, but there's something else that's more important than knowledge. Let's look again at Deuteronomy 17, and we'll see what it is. It says, it is to be with him, and he's to read it all the days of his life. Why? So that he may learn to revere the Lord his God. You see, it's not just a matter of knowing. See, it's a matter of God becoming the controlling motive of my life. It's not, you know, one translation says, fear the Lord. See, it's not being afraid that I'll finally get what I deserve from God. You know, that he'll all of a sudden mete out justice to me when he's been giving me grace all these years. And finally, you know, he'll call the accounts in. That's not what the fear of the Lord is. See, I think when we're talking about the fear of the Lord or revering God, it's a real concern over not smearing his name, of going through life and making sure that we honor him and that he really has top place in our lives. And so it's a matter of motivation. A person who reveres the Lord, his driving motivation in his life is to please God. Now I find in myself that I have to go back and get this straight every day. And I have to do what Deuteronomy 17 says. It is to be with him. He's to read it all the days of his life. And I find that I need to do this so that I'll just correct my perspective. And if I get away from this book for very many days, I just begin to see things improperly. My perspective gets twisted around. And that's serious because then my mental garden starts growing weeds. And I find that I have to do whatever is necessary to weed my mental garden every day. Because the real battleground in your life is not your flesh. The real battleground is the mind. And he who controls the mind will control the rest. And so in Romans 8 it says, the thing thought will lead to life, or the thing thought will lead to death. And so we need to make sure that the predominant influence in our minds as we come away from the scriptures, the predominant influence in our mind is the Word of God. And whatever time it takes to do that, we better do that. Now, why is this so critical? You know, the Apostle Paul, in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, here he is, an apostle, been all over the world, preached the gospel to all kinds of people, tremendously successful, and he says in chapter 9, we've already read it a couple times this week, he says, I beat my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. Here's this man, and he's worried about his body. Because he realizes that either he will have control of his body, or his body will have control over him. And he makes some very interesting observations about people who have lost control of their bodies. For example, in Romans 16, he says in verse 18, he says, for such people, talking about a false teacher, are not serving our Lord Christ, but their own appetites. And so often when he talks about a false teacher, he's saying the person is serving his own appetites, or he's serving his body. In Philippians 3, it talks about the same thing. In Philippians 3:19, it says, their destiny is destruction, their God is their stomach. Interesting. False teacher. His God is his stomach. And I could give you other passages that say the same thing. But you see, Paul realized a very important truth. And that is that false teaching is not just a matter of a person innocently coming up to the Bible and misinterpreting a passage, coming up with just a sloppy exegesis. But false teaching usually comes when we try to turn the scriptures around to make them fit our behavior. And so many times it's not our minds that determine false teaching, it's our glands. You know, we're controlled by our passions. And then we twist the scriptures around to make room for our passions. And I think we all know people who have come out all of a sudden with some rather interesting doctrines. And you look at their lives and you find that they have some very interesting things going on in their lives. And the two match. They're accommodating their behavior. Or there's another thing that drives us to false teaching. That's in Acts 20 where Paul is leaving the Christians in Corinth. And he says, or in Ephesus. And he says, be on your guard. This is verse 30. Remember that for 3 years I never stopped warning each of you night and day. I read verse 31. Verse 30 says, even from your own number, men will arise and distort the truth in order to draw away disciples after them. So if your body isn't going to follow you up, your ego might. See, these people, they'll come along and they'll come up with some new truth. And why do they want to come up with a new truth? Because if they say the same old thing, everybody's going to, you know, they're just going to be one more among the herd. They come up with some new truth, they have a following. And so, you see, false teaching, getting off the track, comes from improper motives. And what Deuteronomy 17 is telling us is that we need to go back to the scriptures constantly to get our motives straightened out, to revere the Lord, and let that be the driving motivation in our lives. And he says, then there's a cause and effect. He says that he may learn to revere the Lord as God, and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees. And so if you revere the Lord, The result is you're going to follow carefully the words of these decrees. And your life will stay on track. Well, let me make a couple of suggestions here just by way of application in this area. I think you get the point of what I'm trying to say. Is that if we get too busy, or for one reason or another, we neglect this book, anything is liable to happen in our lives. And it's not easy. We need to recognize that it's not easy to go to this book and always come up with something. My son is going through, he's 22, and for the first time he's having experience of studying a full load, having a job, and we're into some Bible study together. We're reading the Kings and the Prophets and tying the two together. A little bit behind right now because he says, "Boy, Dad, it's really tough to get the time. I come home at night and he says, I'm dog tired, and I get up in the morning, I hardly get out of bed." And so he's having a hard time finding the time to do this. And I thought to myself, "Well, son, welcome to the rest of your life." That's just the way it is, isn't it? And sometimes you go to the Bible and it doesn't say anything to you. And you come away and you think, "Well, what was all of that about? I didn't understand a thing." But I have found that even as I go into the Scriptures, and even if I don't get something, it has its effect. Because it does clean up my mind. And it does straighten out my thinking. But there are some keys for keeping it alive. You know, it's not that big a deal to master this book. It'll take you a lifetime, but it's not all that complicated. There are 1,189 chapters in the Bible. So if you read 10 chapters a day, every 4 months you'll have read the Bible through. You can read it out loud in 80 hours. Now, I'd suggest that you divide it up between a few sessions. But you can, I mean, it's not that difficult. And I've gotten into the habit of reading the Bible through at least once a year. I've done that for the last 30 years. But the key, I feel, has been to always have live questions that I'm asking as I read the Bible through. Now, that's hard. So many people just go and read the Bible and you ask, "Well, how's it going?" "Well, I'm not getting much." "Well, what are you looking for?" "Well, nothing particularly." I say, "Well, that's what you're getting." You get what you're looking for. And so if you can identify a question, some need that you personally feel, the more personal it can be, the better. Then as you go through the Scriptures, you have your antenna up and you will find things that you never expected to find before. If you just go along and you're not sure what you're looking for instance, what I shared on the kingdom, I think it was Monday night. I spent 5 years reading the Bible through and underlining the word kingdom every time I came across it, the Old and the New Testament. For the first couple years, I didn't know why I was doing it. It just seemed like a theme that important, that there was that common in the Scriptures, had to have a lot of importance. And finally, it fell together. And I realized that here was the third option I was looking for. That as I came into Brazil with the American Christianity kind of in my pocket, I realized that I couldn't pass out because around the people because it was Americanized. And then I thought, well, maybe the alternative would be to Brazilianize the Christianity. But all cultures are fallen. And the Brazilian culture is fallen, and so is the American culture fallen. But the kingdom culture is the ideal. And that is what we preach. And so all of a sudden, it came together. I was looking for some answers to some things. Or what you could do, and this is what I did, on this thing on faith, hope, and love. I went through the epistles a couple times, and every time I came across the word faith or the word hope or the word love, I inked it in my Bible. And so if you look at my Bible, you see every time one of those words appear, there it is inked in. And then I would ask myself a couple of questions. Like, what does faith produce? Where does faith come from? Just those two questions. And I began to understand these things that, you know, took me hours sharing with you. It took me months to get it out of the Scriptures, to be able to share with you. But see, that's the way it goes. If you have questions that you're trying to answer, like right now, I told you that my son and I are going through the prophets and the kings, tying the period of a particular king to the period of the prophet, see what was going on in the kingdom and with the king, what the prophet had to say to that situation and to that king, and you put the two together, and I find that it gives you an awful lot of insight in your daily newspaper. It really helps you understand what's going on. And so if we go to the scriptures looking for something that'll help us in our lives, we will find it. Now, if you try to just read the Bible through from cover to cover, Genesis is fine, Exodus is fine, Leviticus, you start getting bogged down, in the Sinai desert. Numbers, half of it is pretty good, the other half, names and stuff like that. Deuteronomy, it took me 5 years to make head or tail out of Deuteronomy. Finally, it's one of my favorite books. Joshua's kind of a good story, and Judges the same way. But then there are areas there that it's just tough going. And so if you just try to read it straight through, you're going to find that a lot of it is just going to be kind of a desert experience for you the first times around. And so my advice is probably the best little help that you can use is this personal reading record. Now, don't get one that'll give you a guilt complex where it's all marked out, all the dates and everything else, and you're 6 months behind and you're that's demoralizing. Get one without any dates. if you can't, see, that's the solution. If you can't meet the standards, lower the standards. If you have any standards, you're always a success. And so what I do is just to keep track, I'll be in a couple places at the same time. I'll be reading in the Old Testament, and I'll be reading in the New Testament, I'll read in the Old Testament, then I'll be starting in the Psalms, and so I'll spend some time in the desert, and then I'll spend some time, where it's a little bit more green. And I can get my way through that way. But it's really interesting. Every time you go through the Bible, the deserts get smaller. And you'll find that those passages of Scripture that you couldn't make head or tail of at one point, all of a sudden they come alive, and you discover these incredible things in those sections. And so it's like peeling an onion. Every time you read it, you take off another layer, your understanding grows, and so it happens. Now, this is especially important. I feel that what I'm talking about here is a life and death issue for all of us. Because every one of us here are also responsible for our own nation. We all have a nation that we need to take into consideration. And we find that nation in Deuteronomy chapter 6. The nation we're talking about is your family. And what happens to you, dad and mom, or granddad, grandmom, is going to have a tremendous impact on what happens to those kiddos. And he says here, in Deuteronomy chapter 6, he says, "These are the commands God directed me to teach you, so that you," verse 2, "your children and the children after them may fear the Lord your God, so that you may enjoy long life." See, you obey these commands, and you will enjoy a long life. Your nation is not going to crash and burn. And he says, "Hear and be careful to obey, so that it may go well with you, and that you may increase greatly in a land flowing with milk and honey." Then he says, "Love the Lord your God," this is verse 5, "with all your heart, with all your soul. These commands that I give you are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home, when you walk along the road, when you lie down, and when you get up." See, it's our responsibility to pass these things on to our families. We can't delegate that responsibility to any institution on earth. It's ours. And then he goes on and he says, "When the Lord your God brings you into the land he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you, a land with large, flourishing cities you did not build," then he points out a danger point, a particular period in the history of a family that is especially precarious. And he says, it's when you begin to occupy cities you did not build, or you live in houses filled with all kinds of good things you did not provide, wells you did not dig, and vineyards and olive groves you did not plant. Then when you eat and are satisfied, be careful that you do not forget the Lord who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. The danger point is when you begin to have the benefits of things you did not work for. Now, the things that you have, where did you get them? From dad and mom? Well, maybe you're in special trouble then. Your kids, what are you going to leave for them? Will that help them or hurt them? You see, the important thing is that we understand that was the reason Solomon was not supposed to get all those horses or to have all that gold. Because when he had all those things, it was easy for him to trust in those things. Now, it's interesting that God gave the children. He didn't say it was wrong to have those things. In fact, he gave the children of Israel all of those things. And he gave them to them for them to enjoy. But he said, that's the danger point. Be careful. Because that's when it's so easy to forget the Lord your God. Well, that's kind of it. Just want to be sure that you make it. And the reason, the way that you'll make it, is that if you are careful to take time day by day to hear the voice of God and to obey it. Thank you for your attention.